Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one story. Ordinary, looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control. Squad 5. And go to 273-273. And go to Battalion 1818 Battalion. Go to 273-273.
Well, welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. Tonight we have Chip Comstock from Ohio, an attorney at law and a fire chief. We have as your host and MC tonight is John Murphy, retired deputy fire chief and attorney at law in the state of Washington. We are not going to have Kurt Verone tonight. He said he's out and about traveling. And we may have Brad Pinsky, who is traveling to Michigan for some unknown reason, maybe to take over Michigan University or whatever. Whatever Brad does, hopefully he'll join us. So a couple of business things.
Before you continue, just so you know, being from Ohio, I can't talk about that state other than refer to it as the state up north. So Brad's going someplace up north from Ohio. But in my state, we're not allowed to even mention the word.
The M word. All right. We will not mention the M word. So without mentioning the M word, I want to remind everyone of FDIC this April 2020. Just to say that letters of acceptance have gone out to those who will be speaking in this year's session. There has been a lot of surprising rejections of letters, but I just want to say that everybody is a winner on these sorts of things. You're probably all instructors, and you submitted to present your material at FDIC, and our suggestion, and everybody who has been to FDIC several times, says keep putting in your petitions to teach and teach and pass on your knowledge around your local area or your state. I think, Brad, is that you?
That is me, and I just want to say, unless you're a lawyer, don't submit if you're a lawyer. No reason.
Don't submit. So, and I think we're going. I'm going. I know that Brad's going, and I'm hoping that Chip goes because we always have a great class with him, and I'm sure that Kurt is going to be there as well. So we're going to be talking about legal issues.
I've hoodwinked them in again to giving them four for the price of one. So I'll give everybody the opportunity to see us all at one location for one very low price.
I mean, who would not want to see all of us in the same room together?
I know it, and they've done it 2 years in a row, and we've gotten some fairly high marks on it. That lawyers actually know.
That's because I keep filling out the evaluations. We get good marks because they keep letting me fill out all the evaluations. So it's so far it's working.
We always get an A for humor.
Yes, I have a story, but I'm not going to tell it right now. But anyway, we have an interesting sort of an eclectic show tonight. I know that Brad has been out and about and has not been available on some of our past shows. But we're going to be talking about an issue that is near and dear to Chip Comstock's heart. We're going to talk about trademarking the name THE. We'll talk about that in a minute. We're going to talk about, I've gotten several calls lately for some odd reason, residency requirements. And as I was poking through doing some research on it, I wrote an article on it about 3 years ago. So we can talk about that a little bit. And then I think Chip wanted to talk something about a little email and First Amendment rights. Can you trash talk your supervisor and your chief? And then I don't know what Brad wants to talk about. He's driving. He's got windshield time.
My God, that's
going
so
to
much
the
right
M
there.
State.
Who could put more legal issues than you've just imagined? I mean, that's a chock full of legal issues.
Shock and awe, right? Shock and awe.
Right.
So let's, Brad, is there something that you want to talk about that is burning and that you've seen a lot of in your recently in your practice?
Not including the mayor. Can't talk about that.
Yeah, I'm
right.
not going to talk about my own fire department, which I love dearly. You know, there's interesting issues that are coming up. Ours are more state-specific, where we're seeing things about ambulance filling, so we won't talk about that. That's becoming neat. But the one pressing issue, which is the volunteer issue, has always been compensation packages and fair labor standards, which is really a Kurt thing. But no, let's go with yours. If you want to talk about residency requirements, I definitely have you know, comment about that. There's been a number of cities that have done that successfully and not, with good reason and bad reason. So I'm happy to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about.
All right. So I want to talk about what Chip is so fervently in favor of is trademarking. And so the whole thing came out when the Ohio State wanted to trademark the word the. And so it made me laugh because I think, well, do I every time I use the word the or the or T-H-E or whatever, do I have to pay somebody for that? And
our governor,
when I really, I briefly described this to Chip, and he goes, well, you know, that's interesting. It's not so much the Ohio State issue. It is trademarking your patches. And one of the issues that came out after 9/11 was, you know, there's a lot of knockoff on FDNY patches and, you know, gear, clothing and hats and pins and badges and stuff. There was a big movement to trademark the logo. And so I don't know if that ever came to fruition.
I do that for people. I will tell you, I do that for people. And so what happens in my world is that the fire department gets a member and he starts selling their fire department logos and or creating stationery or business cards or all these things. And specifically shirts become the big problem. And if the member leaves and starts putting the logo on, especially when they start to jump into Chip's world, start putting on things with not so nice sayings, right? So the, let's say, Smithtown Fire Department, you know, Smithtown, New York Fire Department, and people have these shirts that say, you know, then sucks, but they use the logo as Smithtown Fire Department. Or one I just had, which there's actually a federal law on, strangely enough, is websites. When somebody creates a fake website and uses the logo of the fire department to make it look like it's a real, like it's the real thing. So I've had this issue recently. I do, in fact, by the way, trademark names of fire departments and their logos. I've successfully done logos. I have a harder time with the names of the fire department unless they add in the state, because, you know, there's 10 million Smithtown fire departments. So that one becomes problematic. But the logos, yes, as long as, you know, they don't the issue with logos, just so you know, is like with an EMS logo. Let's say an EMS organization wants to do a logo. If they use the caduceus in it, that's already trademarked. So they have to, you know, it becomes harder, but it's doable. I've done it. But you got to be careful if you're using other parts like the Star of Life or other things that already exist as somebody else's trademark. But you definitely can trademark fire department logos and names. Names are harder when they're common. And I, you know, I recommend it. But the issue came up for me recently in New York State when somebody was pissed off their fire department to create a fake website. And they used the logo on the website. So the question is, was that permitted? It turns out there's a federal law that prohibits that sort of thing, imitating somebody else's, you know, website and directing people to a fake website. But I also wanted to raise the trademark issue, and I don't know what, like 99% of fire departments don't trademark their, at least in my experience. Do you guys have other experiences where fire departments or EMS organizations are actually trademarking their logos and or sites or their, you know, their names?
No, you know, I raised the issue because
you know, John was kind of kidding me earlier about trademarking Ohio State, you know, the word D, but it's huge business. And, you know, they do it for a number of reasons, but certainly it's a business. I think with the fire department, we do it not unless you're, again, FDNY, Chicago, or, you know, one of the larger departments. It's not so much a business, but it is really a protection of the name for against misuse of that name. And I think, you know, it doesn't happen often, but it's something that I think we don't think about at all. And that's why I thought it was a good topic for tonight. And, Brad, you've really addressed it in terms of, you know, why it's something we should think about.
Out here in the West, many years ago, Seattle tried to trademark the Maltese cross because they had a unique design that was contained within the Maltese cross. And as you know, the Maltese cross has been around for centuries, they were not successful. And the challenge came is it because it's such a recognizable symbol of the fire service that IAFF has it as part of their, you know, union membership stickers. Fire departments have it. I mean, a lot of organizations is such a common use in the fire service that was very difficult for, I think, the courts out here back in the late 70s, early 80s, that said, well, it's because of the common usage, it would be very difficult to pull back to your, you know, claim of trademark rights that you own the trademark. And so it kind of fell by the wayside and the whole thing kind of disappeared. So, but we're not having any big trademark issues out here. I think it's an interesting discussion because of other trademarking controversies that have gone on, you know, products, food products, clothing, names, you know, those sorts of things. So I thought it was humorous when the Ohio State was going to trademark the word the, and so I thought of Chip, of course.
In Syracuse, New York, which people refer to Syracuse University as CUSE, I guess, but in Syracuse, New York, we have a local manufacturer of whiskey, and they've started making something called CUSE juice, and they make it apostrophe C-U-S-E. Well, that happens to be how University refers to themselves and may be trademarked. They've trademarked the apostrophe as it's used with Q's. So they have put this whiskey business, this is big news where I am, they've put this really cool mom-pop whiskey business out of business, basically, by saying fight because they named it Q's juice with an apostrophe. So everybody else says, well, then just get rid of the apostrophe. But the question is, well, is it too similar to Q? So he said, well, how can you possibly trademark Syracuse, you know, Q's an abbreviation? And yet that's now the issue. So with fire departments, I actually do advise the clients that they should strongly consider trademarking A, their logo, and B, their name. And sometimes, again, they have to put New York or, you know, the state after it because there's too many that way. But I do think it's a good idea because the issue you're going to have is, A, people copy your website or try to make it look like you're something. B, they start branding shirts. And I think the shirt branding thing is the biggest reason to stop people from copying. Now, how many people really want to copy your local fire department? You know, probably none. But if you're the Chicago fire department, I would do that if it's, you know, still possible. But I think it's a good idea. FDNY, everyone sells FDNY stuff, right? So maybe that ship has sailed or maybe not. But as humorous it is, I do think it has created problems with some of my clients when their members go out and, you know, to start making shirts and selling them, especially when they're ex-members or non-members, and they're trying to, you know, sell your local community's fire department's T-shirts. And trademarking is not that expensive. I got to tell you, the filing fees are only a couple $100. It's totally worth doing it.
Maybe I ought to trademark the John Murphy. What do you think?
With an apostrophe.
All right, Mr. Ohio.
Anyway, I don't know how much we could do on this issue, but it's worth it.
I think we supported the governor in his petition to do the. Is it the D or the the? The T-H-E-E.
The.
Jeez. All right, let's move to a city where if I want to work in a city, I have to live there. And so in order for me to live there, I have to move from my town that I live here in North Bend into Issaquah, Washington, as an example, because I won't be able to work for the fire department. Is that legal?
Yeah. Anyone else say no?
No.
You're right.
In Washington.
In Ohio, it is now.
Why now?
So Ohio used to have every municipality, almost every fire department had residency requirements, and so a lot of people who got jobs in inner cities didn't necessarily want to live in the city where they worked, had roots other places. So, you know, you end up having a lot of issues as to whether or not a person was really living in the city where they were required to live. And, you know, again, you'd get, he has an apartment, but he's never there, and where they get mail and, you know, voting registration, all that stuff. And so Ohio passed a law at the state level that said that political subdivision could require residency except for emergency workers. And then you had your choice of restricting residency. I think was either it's within the county or generally within the county or an adjoining county, but you could no longer require residency to that municipality or township. The municipalities and townships fought that in Ohio, arguing that it was interfering with their home rule rights, the rights delegated to the local political subdivision to enact rules for their employees. And when the Ohio Supreme Court had to address which argument prevailed, they cited on the side of the employee. So it's been a great boom in Ohio for the volunteer departments, because in the past you would have a employee who is involved in your volunteer community. You'd train them, the volunteer would get really well trained, gain a lot of experience, and then would be hired away from your community into the employment residency area, and you lose the employee. So now, we're able to keep the employee. They commute to their full-time job, and it's really helped, I think, in Ohio, the volunteer fire service by getting rid of the residency requirement. So I think it's been a good thing. I'm not in favor of residency requirements, but I think they're legal. In states that permit it. I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about it, as far as I know, anywhere in the U.S.
Agreed.
Yeah, there's sometimes municipalities in their job descriptions use the residency requirement to pretty much exclude everybody but the one person they want. You know, so if theoretically you had a chief's job and they said, well, we want, you know, this guy. We want to exclude everybody else from a list, from a civil service list. So we'll make sure you have to have lived here at the time the application's due, you know, which is due in 2 weeks. They end up using those residency requirements for some pretty exclusive positions, and it does exclude almost every other candidate. And it's, you know, I think it's unfortunate, but unfortunate is not illegal. And at least in New York State, it is absolutely legal to use the residency requirements. You know, police are an interesting example, right? Police do not want residency requirements. And some police forces, their police departments, find that even though they wanted their police to reside in the city or the locale because they would know it better and whatever, they found it was a huge security issue. Right, you don't want the police to be walking around at dinner where they just arrested somebody. So there are some reasons why they're not safe practices, but you know, safe versus illegal, two different issues.
Well, I think and we have that sort of the similar discussion in the 70s, 60s and 70s, where a lot of cities and departments required residencies for firefighters and police officers as well. And because it created these sort of hardships, especially in economic times or a disparate impact or discriminatory practices, the state enacted the revised codes of Washington 41.08.075. And it says residency as condition of employment is prohibited. And so because of the discriminatory nature of requiring that, we're finding that, you know, not every firefighter, matter of fact, and even in my fire department where we all used to live in the district or the response area. Now, you know, my firefighters are living up north and on the other side of the mountains. I had a firefighter lived in California, used to fly in, you know, to work 3 days in a row. He'd do shift trades for people. And so I did have one department down south that said, you know, we have a residency requirement. We want to get rid of it. I said, well, it's illegal under the state law. And they go, well, we negotiated it as part of our bargaining agreement. And I was thinking, you know, what are you thinking? You know, why did you do that? And a lot of it came because of pressure from city council or city administration or the mayor or the fire chief that they wanted a readily available fire suppression force in town. And so in spite of the fact that they had firefighters on duty, sometimes they had, you know, fairly significant fires at the wood mill or down in the shipyards or those places. And so they wanted to be able to do a recall of off-duty firefighters. And so they would come, you know, to the city in a timely manner and help suppress the fire. I think Michigan is another state.
Where I'm driving to right now.
Yeah, so they can't make you live in the city that you're going to work in. Oh, I used the M word. I'm sorry, Chip. Please accept my apologies. But anyway, they have a residency requirement for public employees, but they exempt volunteer firefighters. So volunteer firefighters, apparently in that state that begins with an M, are required to live in the city or the town that they provide services for. So what I've seen, and I've taught a couple of classes where firefighters would come up to me and ask about residency requirements, and a couple of them lived in Oregon. And in Oregon, there is a couple of departments there that require their firefighters to live in the city. The issue is one of those arty-farty cities where the cost of living is fairly high, the cost of purchasing property in a home is fairly high, but the salaries of the employee is not commensurate with cost of living. And so the spouse, if there is one, has to work, or you know, two or three people have to live together, you know, in a communal sort of environment, so they can afford, you know, to live. And so the firefighter indicated that the fire chief stated, well, he wanted to create more family time, and to create more family time and less travel time, then you have to live in the city with your family and that sort of stuff. And the blowback on that was, I don't ever get to see my family because both of us are working, you know, all the time. So I'm not a big fan of residency requirements. I think it was something in the heyday of yesteryear where, you know, you didn't have a lot of firefighters or police officers in your community, and it was a good thing that, you know, they lived there. But if, you know, sort of the underlying answer or the solution is if you pay your firefighters enough money to live in your community, then all, you know, more power to you. But, you know, in our state, it is against the law unless you, like the department that talked to me and negotiated it into their contract. They're going to get it negotiated out, and I'll make sure that happens in their next contract period of time. But, you know, don't negotiate those things into your contract contrary to state law.
And one of the things you see a lot is you see temporary residency requirements. I want to make 2 points. One is you see a lot of municipalities saying, okay, for the first 3 years you have to be a resident, or at the time of application you have to be a resident. So I find that comment, and frankly that doesn't appall me as long as they don't tie your hand saying you have to live here forever. I always thought that. I never understood how that could be constitutional, right? You get a job, you get a civil service right to hold the job, and then they're basically binding you to the community, saying if you ever leave, you lose your job. So I think the common practice now, and I obviously cannot speak for every state, but where I'm seeing these requirements is that, you know, it's for the first 3 years or 5 years or for a year after application and hire. You know, it's not a permanent thing. You're not required to live there forever or you lose your job. But the other thing I will say is that there are so many, and I have a lot of friends who are getting on with the city of Syracuse, for example, who has a residency requirement, and their requirement that before you apply and when you're hired, you have to have lived there, I think, for a year or something like that, right? You can't just move there right before you get hired. And one of the things everyone does is like 20 people rent an apartment together. And so it's a total sham, and they don't really live there. And they send an inspector when they're going to hire you to make sure you really live there. But, you know, you can't tell who lives there. So I think it's kind of a sham, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, firefighters are smart enough to get around that obstacle, trust me. So the only exemption that we're seeing here in Washington State is if you're an appointed official. So you're generally the fire chief or the police chief or the mayor, you know, those sorts of things. The requirement is to live in the city, and the commensurate pay allows you to make that adjustment to live in the city. But for rank and file firefighters and fire officers, you know, out here, that's not a requirement.
So not that our listeners are going to care, but I have to ask, hey, Chip, how close are you to Toledo?
3 hours.
Okay, well, I'm driving by Toledo, but, you know, we could drive by Tony Paco. So any firefighters who are listening to our show, of which there are probably thousands in Toledo right now listening to our show, because as we know, second to my mother, the Toledo firefighters are our biggest fans on the show, you know, I'll meet at Tony Paco's in 3 hours.
Well, and I've been there. There are a number of them. I've been to the original where Klinger made the place famous.
Toledo famous.
That's right. Along with the mud hens, and we talked before you got on, and I'm going to give you the quiz. Who is our FDIC friend, fire engineering award winner, who used to be a chief officer in the Toledo Fire Department?
Not you, huh?
Dave Moore.
Skip Coleman.
Oh,
Skip Coleman.
Okay.
Wow. Bit of trivia there.
Deputy Chief of Toledo Fire Department, now retired and living in, I believe, southwest Ohio near Cincinnati. So, but, yeah, Skip was very active. And you know, the other persons up in that area that I'll give right outside of Toledo is Paul Combs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I will.
Ohio,
we're going to drive by his house right now. And if Paul's listening, and as we know, our third biggest fan is probably Paul Combs. He likes to draw portraits of our radio show, very, very highly sought after. So, hey, guys, I've got to bail off this show because the throughway is calling our name. And as we drive by Chip's neighborhood and we arrive in the M state that we can't mention, I'll be thinking of all you guys.
All right.
And we're thinking about all these about you.
Have fun.
Always.
But I'll leave my
have fun up in the M state.
Take care, guys.
All right. Take care. Safe travels. So one of the things that I think that Chip wanted to talk about too, which I find is, you know, we talk about it quite a bit, is emails, First Amendment rights of firefighters. And can you, I may be phrasing this incorrectly, but can you trash talk your fire chief over social media or through your email system? And so I'm going to turn the beginning of the discussion over to Chip. And then there's an interesting case here in Washington State I want to talk about as well. So,
sorry.
Go ahead.
I got a call from a friend earlier today who said, and you know, it's a relatively new chief, but that doesn't mean anything because I think chiefs of any length of service have been subject to members or employees who take the social media to talk trash about either the chief abilities or things that are going on with the department. and they vary. You know, some are very specific, fact specific about the chief. Some are just about, you know, management style. Some are about defects in the department, and it's often very difficult to ignore. And the question is, you know, this guy's just a pain in my side. You know, how do I deal with it? And the initial and easiest, if you can get away with it, is just to ignore it and just keep doing your job and do your job well, and that eventually you hope that it will go away. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it causes a real dilemma as to whether or not you should discipline. And of course, even when you take discipline, there's usually going to be a pushback, and then you have to be prepared to go for the next round. So it really is a fact specific case. You can't give advice that works in every situation. You have to look and say, what's going on? What's the result? What's the crisis that's been created? And we've talked about this many, many, many times as to what the rules and standards are. And so I'm just going to kind of run down it. And I'll tell you that Kurt Verone and I, who talk a lot about the First Amendment, we always end up in the same place, but Kurt and I, our analysis is the approach is just a little bit different. But again, I think we ultimately talk about the same thing. And I start off and say, is the employee's job duties involve speech? And typically, the average firefighter, they don't. So we don't get into the analysis as to whether or not it's work-related speech or not. And if it's work-related speech, it's not protected. So we don't go there. The next question is, and it's sort of hand-in-hand, is the employee speaking as a private citizen on a matter of public concern? And usually, if they're not on the clock, if they're home, they're sitting at their computer, they're on their phone someplace, and they're just putting stuff out there or sending emails, they're generally going to be writing. They're going to be writing or communicating as a private citizen. The issue is going to be, is it a matter of public concern? And this is where it gets very interesting, because if they're just complaining about things that are taking place that affect the firefighters only. You know, I get scheduled overtime, or we're doing this, or I don't like the color of uniforms that are being purchased, etc. Things that the general public really won't care about, then it doesn't have protection. If you're talking about manpower shortages or slow response or discrimination in the fire service or the fire department, or that the engine that isn't being repaired and it may break down, or we're closing fire stations, things that the general public would have an interest in, would want to know, then it may be protected speech. And so when you take action against the employee in those circumstances, the employee is going to say, listen, I raised an issue on my own time about a matter that is of public interest, of public concern, and therefore I have the protection of the First Amendment, which is likely to be true. And if in those circumstances, however, the inquiry is not over, the courts are going to say, okay, fine, but were there any negative impacts as a result of the speech? The courts recognize that a fire department, employees have the right to write on matters of public concern as under the First Amendment. The courts also recognize that employers have the right to maintain discipline. And so in those circumstances, the courts are going to use what we call the Pickering balancing test. And it's basically looking and saying, you know, which side has the greater interest and where has there been the greater harm. And so if a chief can point to disruption caused by the employee speech, you know, either within the department or within the community, where it was real, you can point to say this has caused a real problem. Courts in that cases are likely going to decide with the fire chief. But if the fire chief is just upset because he doesn't like what the employee says and it just makes him feel bad, but he can't really point to any real harm, it's going to be harder to win that case. And in those situations, it's probably best for the employer, the chief, to just ignore the speech and continue on with, you know, the good work that he or she is doing. John, so you said there's a case out there in your state. Well, John is probably looking up the information. You know, while I'm waiting for John to get back on, a couple things that do come out that are real interesting is when you see some of the, and where it's critical is that the speech that makes the news that we see nationally. Captain in Miami-Dade, Florida, who writes about the people they're serving, firefighters who said they were in New York City were trying to bring attention to discrimination in Queens by getting on a float with blackface paint. Firefighters who show up at swearing in of the fire chief with protest signs. Chiefs who write letters to commissioners who write letters to neighboring departments accusing them of cheating on grants and causing problems between the two departments. These are just a couple of the examples where there was actual harm caused in relationships either with the public or between departments or even within departments. And courts just generally don't tolerate that type of behavior. They recognize the esprit de corps that fire departments are to have, you know, serving one another in providing service to the public. And so when there's an interference with that, courts are likely going to defer to the action taken by the employer. And that is where we find that employees are absolutely wrong if they believe they have an absolute First Amendment right to put out into social media any of their thoughts without fear of discipline, because they are subject to discipline.
Right. So one of the things that you said earlier, Chip, was that, and I believe me or trust or correct me if I'm wrong, but each First Amendment case is unique based on fact patterns. Is that correct?
Yes.
So when I talk about social media and First Amendment rights, and when I do my review classes, it's not, there's no black, there's black and white. The Pickering test basically is the test that has been used, you know, local court, Supreme Court, all over the place, and taking a look at First Amendment, you know, whether you're protected under First Amendment, but each of those cases are fact specific to determine whether your rights under the First Amendment are protected speech rights. And it's just so there's a deep analysis that goes on by the judiciary in order to determine the outcome of your case and whether you do have First Amendment protections for speech.
Yes.
Yes. Good. Okay. So the case Yes, but it depends, right?
No, I think your analysis is correct, and again, it comes down to at the end of the day, the courts are going to run the facts through the machine and decide, you know, which way they're going to come out after they do this analysis. And often is the problem with First Amendment cases, as Kurt and I often debate, is that the outcome is often unpredictable. I mean, we might give you our best guess, but there's a couple times we've guessed wrong, and so. It's just not that clear.
Well, the case that I'm not going to talk about, but I want to mention is there's a firefighter case, and we've seen this around in several jurisdictions where they dismantle a particular team for budgetary reasons. And this one was a dive team that apparently, through the budgetary constraints, they cut the dive team. They had a few drowning events. One of the firefighters who was on the dive team was highly incensed. And so he goes to the city council meeting, identifies himself as a firefighter, identifies the problem was not very complimentary to the chief or the administration as to their decision. So he was pretty rude. You know, the outcome that he was looking for was they reinstate the dive program, not only because he was a team member, but because of, you know, his belief was that the dive team was instrumental in public safety. And so the department suspended him. And he filed a lawsuit against the department saying you violated, I had a free right of free speech under the First Amendment to make those, you know, those statements in a public forum. And so the, you know, they go to trial, of course, and then the, you know, the judges, the judge said, yes, you did identify yourself as a firefighter, because one of the tenets of the Pickering rule is you speak in as a citizen, right? And he identified himself. He said, in spite of the fact that he was identified himself as a firefighter, was somewhat rude to the administration, the chief and the city council. It wasn't an interest of public concern that the dive team was instrumental in saving lives. And so they said, yes, in this circumstance, you do have, you know, rights of free speech under the First Amendment. So, but that's an individual, that's that court, you know, it's not every court that's going to allow, you know, that sort of discourse to occur. So the case I want to kind of just talk about a little bit more is the Spokane, Washington case. It's called Spray.
Hey, John, John, before,
yeah, go ahead.
Before you continue, there's two things I want to bring up. One, the case that you were just talking about, the dive team, did you see what state that was in?
That was in the Ohio state.
It was.
Was it not?
Federal district court case, and it went up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is, you know, the federal appellate court. And there's another interesting holding. They went through, and the city tried to argue it wasn't a matter of public concern in that case, and the court ultimately said it was. And there was an issue about whether he was speaking as a private citizen or whether he was a member of speaking as an employee, and the court found he was speaking as a member of a private citizen. And then but they didn't get to the Pickering test, because what the lower court had said was the speech was not truthful. He said that what he said at the meeting was not accurate. And when the appellate court reviewed it, they said the speech, in fact, it appeared that it was accurate, and it was probably a question of fact for a jury, that the judge couldn't dismiss the case. But one of the biggest holdings in that case is that if an employer is claiming that the employee lied, because one of the critical issues that we haven't talked about in the First Amendment with people spreading information out is that false statements, fraud, hate speech, those type of things are not protected.
Not protected.
And
right.
So if somebody writes things about a chief and you can show that they're all lies, there's just no protection for that speech. The First Amendment doesn't apply. But what the case held in this case is that the burden of demonstrating the lies is on the employer. The employee doesn't have to prove that his speech was truthful in order to obtain the First Amendment protection. It's that the employer has to prove that the speech was not truthful in order to take away the First Amendment protection. And so I think ultimately the Sixth Circuit sent the case back to the trial court and said, you have to figure all this out in light of our instructions and our new rules that we're going to apply. You know, figure out now whether he had protected speech or not. And I think when they went back, as it happens often, the case settled, and that was the end of it. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. And that's actually one of the cases that I have done in the past as part of our First Amendment material that we've done through FDIC. And we've talked a little bit about in our burning issues class.
Yeah.
So tell us about
the
Washington case.
Thank you for the clarification. So the Washington case, this is an interesting case. So only from the perspective of departments that manage their own email systems, and they have rules and regulations about posting certain materials, which we all do, right? Can't put this on there, can't put that on there. It's pretty much for business only. And so a fire captain, and the case is entitled Sprague versus Spokane Valley Fire District. This is happened several years ago, but Supreme Court finally weighed in last year in the firefighter's favor, indicating that he did have a First Amendment right to do what he did. And so the facts are the Valley Fire District, you know, obviously had prohibited any personal use of department email. One of their members committed suicide, a sad affair for their organization and family. And so the district provided its employees with information about suicide prevention through its employee assistant program email newsletter, and invited employees to use their email accounts, the city's email accounts, to discuss the issues and provide other resources. When the captain weighed in on the issue from a Christian perspective, including scripture quotations in his emails sent to other firefighters who shared his beliefs, he was told that the district policy prohibited discussion of religious issues over district email. He refused to cease and desist, so they fired him, right? So he filed a lawsuit saying, you violated my First Amendment rights. So it sort of wound its way through the court system, and it ended up in the Washington State Supreme Court, who reversed the lower court's decision and found that the district's policy of permitting the use of email for some social issues but prohibiting employees from providing a religious perspective on those issues amounted to viewpoint discrimination that violated Captain Sprague's First Amendment free speech rights, right? So Chip, this is a rhetorical question, but we don't usually talk about viewpoint discrimination when we talk about First Amendment protections.
You know, I mean, that case where people are trying to not discriminate and protect, you know, from an employer standpoint, because you're always afraid that somebody's going to say, well, you're permitting your positive support of a Christian-based religion or some other based religion. So, you know, the employer tries to take religion out of the equation, so we don't have to deal with it. We're not going to get into that. And now that, you know, I understand from your description the court's decision, I just wonder what the practical effect of that is going to be, where, you know, we're going to sit down and now everybody, we're going to make decisions in government that are going to include an analysis of religion. And, you know, I would think from the government standpoint that would be a very interesting case to take up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, you know, under our current court system, I can see the court supporting viewpoint viewpoint discussion. Although I question what would happen, or if it would be a different outcome, if it was a religion other than Christianity.
Yeah, very good question. Right, and you know, that's one of those. Who knows? Could be different, right? So let me go on with this, because there's another interesting aspect of this as well. So the Supreme Court, you know, when they ruled that he did have First Amendment free speech rights, it rejected the district's First Amendment Establishment Clause defense, because the captain only sent the emails to fellow employees who consented to receiving them, ensuring that there was no significant risk that anyone would mistake the captain's religious views for the official views of the district itself. So this was like another case that the National Labor Relations Board jumped into with, I think, AMR Ambulance a number of years ago, when one of the employees was trash-talking supervisors over her social media sites and was terminated. And the National Labor Relations Board came in and said, well, this is coffee table talk. You know, it was a limited audience. It didn't go out to the general public. Nobody else knew what was going on. It's like sitting around the coffee table, which, you know, we do all the time, right, as firefighters. So I think we need to kind of take a look at, you know, the Establishment Clause defense, which is the separation of church and state, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And, all right. So And the limited distribution to people who were like-minded, I think, made a big impact on the decision by the Supreme Court. So there's, and you can look this up, and I'll give you the website for this. It's an interesting sort of distillation of a long protracted case. What, through the Municipal Research Council for the State of Washington, it's MRSC.org, MRSC.org. Just type in Sprague, and it will run you through an analysis of, you know, several years of going to court. And they take a look at, first of all, you got to be careful about what you allow on your email system. That's our policy. But if you open up your email system to commentary, right, that's not the usual business sense, but to grieve for a fellow firefighter or that sort of stuff, you're going to have to expect that some people are going to be using that forum for their own viewpoints, right? Their own personal discussions. And then the other part is they talked about the issue of the Public Records Act. Like Washington State, many states have a public records law that says, you know, anything created by government within reason is disclosable. And so what they ended up saying is that while the opinion doesn't reference the Public Records Act, the court ruling that the captain has sent emails as a private citizen does highlight the fact that any personal emails are not sent by employees while acting in the scope of employment. And so that, you know, the issue is, are these emails disclosable, right? So we'll see what happens when somebody's asking for all those emails. And then it says use caution with the last one was use caution when imposing any content-based restrictions on employee speech. So if you're going to have a policy and a rule that email is only for X, Y, and Z, if you open it up, then all of those rules go out the window. And so you're going to have to deal with a whole new sort of beast, I guess, as far as, you know, what is a correct usage of your email system? And are you protected under the First Amendment, which we always say that not all speech is free, right? So anyway, that's Sprague versus the Spokane Valley Fire Department. It's an interesting case. The Municipal Resource Council kind of boils this down into like 1.5 or 2 pages worth of stuff on there. It's good for organizations to read, and especially if you allow, you know, other than business material on your email system, you're going to have some issues. So that was a great topic.
They always are, all of them.
All right, so we've been at it for, you know, our lawyer time. I really don't. I think we talked about residency requirements. We talked about emails. We talked about that awesome trademark. Who knew that Brad Pinsky was a trademark wizard? Anyway, he may be able to help the governor help, you know, get the as a trademarked. And then, yeah, that's about it. And then we talked about FDIC. Hope to see everybody there. We're going to be there giving classes and offering free legal advice. It gets freer the more beers you buy us and more verbose. So anything else, Chip?
I think that's it.
All right. I appreciate you on the show and to all of our thousands of listeners, including the two Mrs. Pinskys, we bid you a awesome good night. Good night, yeah. Right. Good night, Chip.
Good night.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.